Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming to our fourth presentation in a series. I'm Rachel Markle, the Director of Planning and Community Development, and I also really appreciate your patience while we sorted through our technical difficulties. We would be showing you the vision video tonight, but that's not going to be possible. But please go to the City of Shoreline website, specifically the comprehensive plan page, and check it out if you haven't seen it yet. It's a really great video that goes through the city's vision statement, Vision 2029. And now I'd like to turn the show over to the City of Shoreline's Mayor, Keith McGlashlin, who will introduce our speaker.
Thank you, everybody, for being here. We have to use the microphone because, of course, we're videotaping these so that people can watch them. I was just going to introduce Councilmember Jesse Solomon, but he walked in, and now he just walked out. So, all right, we won't do that. So thank you for coming to our fourth of a series. As Rachel said, we are working towards our comp plan update, and these talks are inviting speakers to come and talk to us about things that hopefully you all will chat about after the speaker speaks, and some of these ideas that we can come up with through the speakers and through conversations will end up in our comp plan update. So this is where I'm supposed to introduce the video. Sorry, there is no video. So we will start here with introducing our speaker tonight. So tonight we have Rob Bennett with us. Rob is the founding executive director of the Portland Sustainability Institute and most recently from the Clinton Climate Initiative, Residential and Cities Policy Manager. He's developed comprehensive residential pilot programs for Houston and Chicago and also provided technical assistance to cities throughout throughout North America in areas of climate change reductions, and building performance policy. Prior to that, he spent 8 years working directly for the cities of Vancouver, BC, and Portland, Oregon. I understand in Vancouver, he led development of the Comprehensive Green Building Strategy and facilitated green building and infrastructure activities for Southeast Falls Creek redevelopment, which became the 2010 Olympic Village. And in Portland, he founded the Green Building Program and led conservation programs and policy development in areas of energy efficiency and corporate sustainability. God, all these big words in there, I tell you. A graduate of the University of Massachusetts Amherst School of Landscape, Architecture, and Regional Planning, he has served on the Cascadia Region Green Building Council and REACH Community Development Boards. So now let's all give a big, warm Shoreline welcome to Rob Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. It's a pleasure to be here. I had a fun time with some staff earlier today talking through this notion of eco-districts. And so we're going to spend the next hour or so talking a bit about green neighborhood development, some of the work that we're doing in Portland, in support of other places around the country, and hopefully how it's relevant to your comp plan and the vision, as I understand it, to create a community here of neighborhoods and neighborhood centers. And I think most of us who live in our community, we feel very strongly about the sense of neighborhood as a major driver for how we feel about our lives and how we connect with our neighbors and how we order ourselves in the broader context of city and region. So from my perspective, neighborhood development is critical. I spent the last 20 years doing community development work and working, as the mayor said, within city government, promoting green buildings, promoting green neighborhood development. And then most recently, with the experience of the Olympic Village and some large-scale redevelopment projects in Portland, felt strongly that we needed to build a market strategy around green neighborhood development, and that's what eco-districts is in a nutshell. And I'm going to talk about it today and hopefully get into a good conversation with you about the impacts and opportunities here in Shoreline. So by way of background, I am the executive director of the Portland Sustainability Institute. We were founded by our current mayor, Sam Adams, in 2009. as an independent 501c3 nonprofit that was in service to the city. And our role is to play this intermediary, if you will, role between business, local government, and higher ed. In this case, it's a partnership we have with Portland State University to help generate project ideas and strategies that can be implemented over time to promote sustainability. Our first project was eco-districts, and it takes up a majority of our time. We've got a 5-neighborhood pilot program in partnership with the city and the Portland Development Agency and Portland State that's underway. And that is where, as a small organization, we spend a majority of our time. So what is an eco-district? And I think whenever you sort of put a term to use in a brand, it has sort of benefits and drawbacks. The benefit is that it's sort of in one and community vitality along with the more traditional environmental performance metrics of energy, water, waste, et cetera, that you would think of when it comes to green building. We think the neighborhood's an important scale to explore and ultimately make investments in. If you think about it, the buildings, the advancements we've made in buildings that I think are reflected in this building have come a long way in 10, 15 years. We know how to build green buildings. They've been mainstreamed to a certain extent in the building industry and the design and development industries. And likewise, we're particularly in the Pacific Northwest, we do a pretty good job of regional planning and making investments in regional transportation infrastructure and growth management and smart growth. What's been missing is what do we do about neighborhood scale development and how do we incorporate sustainability into either neighborhood revitalization and or new master planned development that has been happening at a rapid clip in much of the U.S. And much of the world for quite a long time. When we talk about eco-districts, they can be described in many ways, but one thing, though, just to keep it simple, we try to break it down into 3 major categories. One is brownfield and new development. It could be greenfield as well, but these are large-scale, typically master-planned communities with a single developer or a consortium of developers who've come together to develop a new neighborhood or a mixed-use community. There's campus sustainability and sort of eco-districts at the campus level, whether it be corporate campuses like Adobe or Microsoft or Google, an organization we're working with in the coming weeks, or a hospital or a university. These are often also single ownership neighborhoods that have a tremendous amount of infrastructure. In some cases, they're mixed use. In other cases, they're single use, in the case of Google, versus the UW. And then there's existing neighborhoods, and this is the majority of how we live in the cities and communities that we live in. Existing neighborhoods that have some level of infrastructure and buildings in place, and you're looking at interventions and revitalization strategies to make that neighborhood stronger, to make that neighborhood a more vital and livable place. And each of these typologies or types of eco-districts have different needs and different strategies that you would attach to them. And we organize eco-districts in sort of 3 areas: buildings, infrastructure, and people. Or in this case, we're describing the people in sort of behavior and choice. But what we're trying to say here is that there is sort of best practices, obviously, in buildings. Again, I think we feel fairly comfortable what we know what we're trying to accomplish with green buildings. Infrastructure, the layering of transportation infrastructure, utility infrastructure, and placemaking through public realm, that's an area that needs increasingly more attention to do it in a more integrated fashion. There's a lot of opportunities with eco-districts to improve in that area. And then, of course, how people live in neighborhoods, whether they work in a particular district like a Google or a Microsoft campus, or they live in a mixed-use or primarily residential neighborhood, what is it that they can do to increase the sustainability performance and ultimately make their community more livable by reducing the energy use and water use or increasing sort of community vitality and livability? So we take a very sort of strong perspective that you need to integrate all 3 of those in very tactical and practical ways. So on green buildings, you know, it might be multi-block development. It may be an innovative, you know, cutting-edge building like the one I show on the left. That's a new retrofit of a federal facility in Portland, where they're putting a massive sort of green wall on the west facade to create shading and reduce heat load, or other sort of innovative building strategies. It includes, again, smart infrastructure, where you're layering in district utilities, stormwater, habitat functionality, and waste management. And then finally, again, in sort of behavior and community action, you're looking for ways to engage your community in new ways. So there's a lot of civic entrepreneurialism that happens in neighborhood levels. There's people who organize organically to start a community garden, or there's others who come together to paint low-income houses. There's a lot of what I call civic entrepreneurialism happening at the neighborhood level, and there's a lot of programs that cities deliver to neighborhoods as well, recycling programs, weatherization programs, low-interest loans for storefront improvements. There's a variety of techniques, both sort of driven by economic development or driven by sort of urban renewal that cities deliver to their communities and constituents. And then there's some really interesting new platforms. There's this one that I'm showing on the left, IOBY, in our backyard. It's basically what they call a crowdsourcing for fundraising platform. It started in New York, and it basically is a way for small neighborhood projects to raise money locally to do the projects that they have in mind. The average gift for in our backyard project is $35. It tends to use social, you know, uses online giving, and the person who provides a donation tends to live within 2 miles of the project. So there's some really interesting sort of new sort of technological platforms to help neighborhood scale projects thrive and to proliferate. And then there's tools like the one I'm showing in the middle, which is the San Francisco Eco Map, that's by neighborhood, by zip code, parsing out information around the carbon impacts of that neighborhood. So you can go to any, if you live in one of those zip codes in San Francisco, you can find out what your energy performance in the district is, what your transportation impacts and your waste impacts and your overall carbon footprint. And this becomes a very useful tool for cities to deploy their resources in their community because you're looking for the best bang for the buck in delivering services. And by being able to use the neighborhood as an important neighbor, an important sort of area for investigation and therefore data mining, you're able to focus programs in a more efficient and effective way. So we view these three things, building, smart infrastructure, and sort of behavior and community action, as the sort of fundamentals of ecodistricts. And the challenge is to put programs and investments together where you're unleashing all three. And again, we're looking at the issues of scale. What are the projects that make the most scale at the neighborhood level that you wouldn't necessarily deploy at a municipal level and you wouldn't deploy at a building level? Last mile transportation. What would you do to help increase the multimobility of a neighborhood by making investments in that neighborhood, knowing that you have a regional transportation network, for instance, for transit or for cycling? What would you do around district utilities so you could potentially create an energy strategy for renewables and local distribution and creation of energy? These are the kind of questions and sort of projects that we're seeking in eco-districts and the financing mechanisms and the policy mechanisms that come to be able to implement those projects. I thought I'd give you a sort of visual tour of some of the component parts of eco-districts. These will be familiar to many of you, I assume, but they start to tell a story about how these things go together and sort of the visual kind of opportunity to improve your community. Obviously, we start with the fabric of the neighborhood. And in this case, in Shoreline, you're looking, obviously, to densify and build more mixed-use communities, neighborhood centers between now and 2029. And so you look for those opportunities where they exist to grow and to create more placemaking opportunities. This is the Brewery Blocks in Portland. This was a derelict neighborhood just 20 years ago. It was mostly abandoned old warehouse and some facilities for the rail yards. And like so many of these types of neighborhoods over the last 20 years have been reinvented as a highly gentrified mixed-use community. One of the signature projects that turned more traditionally sort of smart growth neighborhood into an eco-district was this project. This project was five blocks. It was the first wide-scale application of a LEED rating system back about 10 years ago. They did things around waste mitigation and recycling of the buildings and the materials in the buildings in clever ways that we hadn't seen in Portland. For instance, in the brew, this is the old brew facility, the old brewery tanks were commissioned for rainwater harvesting to manage fire suppression. We obviously carefully knit new buildings with old, and you know, so the major story here is just about adaptive reuse and refurbishing a wonderful set of buildings and integrating new and denser uses so that it came alive. So this is a very important project in the sort of evolution, I guess, of eco districts in Portland. Yeah.
The derelicts. What did you do with them?
It was abandoned neighborhood for many years for the most part, and then artists and squatters moved in because it was cheap or free, and then ultimately developers started to make investments. They first started in lofts, loft conversions, and then commercial, the commercial tenancy came much later than residential, but over time it's just gentrified to the point where buildings are converted and people either priced out or they move out, depending on what's going on. So it's been this 15-year sort of conversion of a neighborhood that saw very little investment and very little occupancy to fully occupied and very expensive real estate. So it includes, provision of district utilities. This is Northern Europe, where district energy is the most robust. Where they, instead of every building having their own energy plant, they have made a commitment to having centralized energy, thermal energy production facilities that then provide efficient heating and cooling to buildings, both commercial and residential. What's important about district energy and why we're so interested in it in Portland, and why it's actually many communities around North America becoming very interested in it, is just a simple sort of math equation. So Portland has 500,000 buildings, roughly. That means every building owner has to do a net present value calculation on what systems to install in their building and has to figure out how to maintain those systems. And we all do that as homeowners. We've had to make decisions about what kind of equipment we put in our buildings and how to pay for it and what the best value is over time. Well, in cities like Stockholm or Copenhagen or Malmö, they don't make those decisions. Just like we have provision for waste services or other utility services, they have a simple bill, a simple tariff that they pay, and the utility takes care of the equipment. They take care of the equipment in your building to distribute into your suites or into your commercial space, and they take care of the energy supply and the energy heating plant. And in the case of Copenhagen, they were able to reduce their overall greenhouse gas emissions by 40% in 10 years by just fuel switching their facilities, because they basically have 10 facilities, 10 major power plants that they've converted to more efficient fuels over time, bringing down the cost of energy, helping increase the sort of energy security, and weaning themselves further and further off of fossil fuels, and that they got to make a utility scale decision versus all of us having to make these same decisions time and again. In the case of Portland, that would you would require 500,000 people to make 500,000 building owners to make a decision towards cleaner energy, whereas in Copenhagen, the utility makes those decisions, and they make them with the most efficient equipment and a utility scale financing scheme, where cost of capital and return on investment is quite different from the kind of decisions that we have to make as property owners. So district energy is another major component of eco districts. Now, in a community like Shoreline, you probably wouldn't be creating district energy schemes, but you certainly would be creating district energy strategies. You would be looking at how to create communities that are low carbon, low energy, by either some form of potential sharing of energy and shared energy systems and or renewable systems and or building efficiency platforms in a more comprehensive manner than we currently do through our building codes. This is an example of the district energy plant that we built in Vancouver for the Olympic Village. So what's interesting about this is mining heat waste, waste heat from sewage. So there was a large sewage pipe that runs through the site, and we needed to build a new pumping station anyway because of the new development that was happening in the site. And we got a twofer. We built a new pump station, and we created a heat plant that basically inserted a heat exchanger into the waste, which runs about 60 Fahrenheit year-round. We use a heat pump, a very efficient electric heat pump, to generate the kind of temperatures. Then it's a distribution very efficient pipes to bring heat to the community. So the whole community that serves about 3 million square feet, it can grow to serve about 6 million square feet, is a pipe about 10 inches in diameter. That's the outgoing pipe from this plant, serves 6 million square feet of development. It's quite efficient, and it's a great community asset. This thing has ongoing tours and other ways to tell the story of energy in the community. The stacks glow different colors depending on the energy use in the neighborhood, and it provides a very visual symbol of energy use and energy management in that community. In essence, we're starting to express energy in different ways. When, you know, most of us, energy is something that is produced far away in hydro or electricity, or it's delivered in natural gas. We don't think about energy a whole lot, and of course, those days are coming to an end. We have to think a lot about energy. Energy is getting more expensive, and the cost of securing energy is becoming more expensive. So, the clean energy, those countries and those cities that move on the clean energy sort of path are going to be the most competitive in the future, from my perspective. Again, eco-districts, you don't think of it as a single building. This is a senior housing project in the Olympic Village, net zero energy. They were able to achieve net zero energy by using solar thermal, and in essence, the total production of the hot water that's produced through this system is equivalent of what their building uses in a year. But it's not just being delivered to the building, it's being delivered to the district energy facility for the whole community. So it's part of a broader system, but the building's able to claim net zero energy because of the total energy that's produced with the solar thermal on site. And that is owned by the utility. So again, it wasn't the burden of the building owner to deploy that system. That solar hot water system is part of the greater utility and delivers energy to the whole neighborhood. This is a building in Portland, the first building to deploy wind turbines. Now, these wind turbines are interesting and fun. They don't produce a heck of a lot of energy. The developer wanted to do it from a placemaking and from a sort of a branding perspective, and they were working with labs at the University of Oregon and Portland State on the efficacy of wind in wind production in urban settings. So they were really interested to understand how the winds sort of at low elevation sort of act and what kind of sort of consistent wind speeds you get for turbines. But again, provisioning energy in neighborhoods. Transportation, obviously, again, last mile. We all have, Shoreline has a transportation network. Every city does. Some communities have more robust multimodal systems. Others are more dependent on automobile traffic. Obviously, in the U.S., we're highly dependent on automobiles to get around, and cities are slowly investing in other modes in building infrastructure. What's interesting, this is Portland. What's interesting about the bike system in Portland was it's just dirt cheap. It was a lot of striping, very few expensive facilities, not a lot of taking parking off. Reducing parking in commercial districts is a really tough thing to do. I'm sure it would be here. It certainly is in Portland. But with With modest investments, we're up to almost 15% mode split of commuters coming to the city who live within 5 miles. So sort of a comfortable bike ride. It's about 15% come by bike year round now. And you think about all those people. Imagine if they were all in cars. You're about four blocks back, stacked up with cars. If those folks were in cars, or obviously if they're in the bus would be a little more crowded. But it's just obviously a great way to get around. It's healthy. It's cheap from an infrastructure development perspective. It keeps cars off the road, so the wear and tear on the roads is less. And interestingly enough, in Portland, the bike economy is adds about $90 million to the economy every year. That's businesses that build bikes, service bikes, bike planning agencies. It's about a $90 million industry in Portland, and it's very homegrown, and it's very, it's sort of organically taken off. So it also has economic impacts of your community as well. Mixing of transit and modes. This is the South Waterfront project, one of our eco districts. It's very important, obviously, to, again, build the infrastructure that allows for people to get around more comfortably. And a green infrastructure. And this is something I know you've done well here. I think a lot of communities in the Pacific Northwest do really well, expressing water management in really interesting ways. When it was pouring rain, 10 minutes ago before we started, the waters were coming down in the scupper outside. And it's just, it's a very different way of managing water than we did even 10 to 15 years ago when we were just getting it into the pipes and getting it out to the Sound, or in our case, out to the Willamette River. You get a lot more placemaking out of this. You get a lot of more sort of interesting co-benefits around green infrastructure and heat island effect. You can start to layer in both green infrastructure at the street level. This is, again, South Waterfront, and also on the rooftop level. The developers of this neighborhood, they were not required to do green infrastructure. They ended up doing it on every one of the buildings because they got this notion of a green neighborhood, or I think they called it a garden neighborhood. So they started envisioning the value proposition as developers, making the incremental costs associated with the development. And they get great placemaking out of it. You can see that's sort of a pedestrian view. What you can't see is there's actually a stream running through. So that's kind of a little river of storm water that creates really a nice feature for all those townhouse owners who walk out and kind of walk across that before they get to the street. This is in Northern Europe, again, where they're using that storm water and actually creating water features of significance for their parks while managing storm water before it gets infiltrated into the ground and into the waterways. Vertical gardens, introducing green where these would be typically hardscaped spaces. Looking at small interventions, this is to shield a parking lot, but it's managing the water for a whole 200 by 200 block in Portland. So no water hits the combined sewer overflow in this building because they were able to provision a bit more space for the green infrastructure. And, of course, it creates a really nice amenity for the building. The city has now gotten into the act. So if you think about cities in Portland, 40% of the city is right of way. So 40% of all real estate in a city in Portland is in roadways. And so that's a lot of stormwater to be managed. And so we've started to build infiltration basins that is managing the water from the crown of the road, something that we weren't doing and touching just 5 years ago. All of that was going into the combined sewer overflow. We started regulating buildings first, and now we're building back into managing infrastructure in the right-of-way. And it gets expressed in different ways. This is a very simple infiltration basin next to a new grocery store. So you can put these things in different places in the right-of-way, and they have a tremendous effect. You can build your parks to manage stormwater. This park takes the stormwater for four blocks that surround the park. Herbert Dreisaitl, who designed this, is a famous German landscape architect. He calls it a biotope, but in essence, the water sheets from the top through the sort of wetland space and into a pond, and then it sort of gets wet and dries up through the seasons and creates a really lovely park area. But again, it has multiple benefits. There's a lot of more insects and bugs and critters that nest in these wetlands. It has a more it provides more sort of ecosystem service benefits than a typical park would. So we're starting to see this kind of design become really common in a lot of places, you know, parks that really have ecological benefits. And then incorporating, of course, play areas. It is ultimately about the people in the neighborhoods and the ability to garden and have activities outside your own home that creates a sense of community. You know, one of the early eco-district activities in Portland that started 30 years ago was community gardening, and now there's over 350 community gardening plots. What's wonderful about community gardening is it's probably in Portland, you know, we're a pretty homogeneous city for the most part. It's probably where you'll see the most diversity in community coming together in any place in the city at any given time. There's just tremendous amounts of people from all cultures who end up in the community gardens because many of them are farming their own sort of traditional ways, and they're farming for their for a significant amount of their food for their family. So they're really wonderful, and they're so cheap. You know, they're so cheap to install. You can do them on in sort of forgotten spaces throughout your community. And then you can go the other extreme, which is put rooftop gardening on the Olympic Village, and this is the Olympic Village green roof strategy. We were required to do green roofs on every project and have 30% of it provisioned for urban gardening. I haven't heard how well the urban gardening is going, but I mentioned it earlier today. I'm going to see the developer next week, and that's one of the questions I'm really interested in. Is this actually working, or are they not using it? Because rooftop gardening has got a set of just practical challenges with soil and sort of how you kind of move and garden on a rooftop and then drag, sort of soil and products and other gardening equipment up and down in very dense buildings. But you can even see there's even play areas built into the roofs as well. And then waste management. Each one of our eco-district pilots has got a zero waste goal. This is sort of the more exotic sort of waste management schemes that you'll see in Northern Europe where they're using vacuum waste systems so they can eliminate trucks on the street and the noise and the pollution and the sort of costs associated with sort of truck routes. And this waste is then managed at a central waste facility. And in the case of Hammarby in Stockholm, that is the feedstock for energy production. So it becomes a closed loop system in certain circumstances. And then finally, I thought just on the sort of visual tour, I'd give you a set of images that we created actually for our own program, because this is the more common approach to eco districts that we're exploring in Portland. That is existing neighborhoods where you're looking for small interventions and small investment, significant but small scale investments to green the neighborhood over time. So a typical kind of building neighborhood where there might be some surface parking and mostly existing buildings, you start to look at, again, creating an energy strategy that would include retrofitting the buildings, perhaps looking at some level of on-site renewables or passive ventilation strategies, passive heating strategies. If there's the ability to connect into district energy, you would do that. You would start to pay attention to the details on transportation at the neighborhood level, what I call end-of-mile interventions. These are bike parking, both on the street and in buildings. This is showers, so people can comfortably cycle to and from or walk to and from work to home, and then can take the get cleaned up as they start their day. Obviously, there's a lot of really interesting innovations going on with car sharing. I don't know if you're familiar with peer-to-peer car sharing, but this has just been launched. So you're, I'm sure, familiar with Zipcar and some of these major companies that have provisioned cars in cities, and Seattle's got them. I don't know if they've made it out to Shoreline. But peer-to-peer car sharing is a totally radical idea that many think will put Zipcar out of business within a few years. And that's simply a $100 box that goes in your car, and your car now can be provisioned and shared with your neighbors or others in your community. So you can create a stream of revenue by sharing your car as you wish and pricing it as you wish using a technology platform with smartphones and phones and computers that allow you to, in essence, put a lot of cars into the marketplace that a lot of them are sitting idle. I know my car sits there at my house all day long, and I wouldn't mind getting $300-$400 a month to defray the cost of owning the car so I can, you know, in essence, for free, make sure I've got a vehicle to go to the mountain or go see my family. So there's some really interesting disruptive technologies happening around transportation and sort of as I think there's someone, Rachel, I forget her last name, and she's out of the UK, but it's, she calls it, it's like shared consumption in essence. It's like these collaborative consumption, thank you. It's just a fascinating development in which technology platforms are providing a way for people to borrow tools, borrow cars, and have a revenue stream from them. And of course, it's an opt-in system. So this is not a social engineering platform. It's an opt-in system. And in San Francisco, in the first 3 months of Getaround, which was the first peer-to-peer car sharing, there are 3,000 cars in the system. There's not 3,000 cars in all of Zipcar's network in the U.S. So this is a really fascinating development that I think you're going to see, and becomes part of the sort of the platform, if you will, for eco-districts, thinking about shared systems. And then, you know, we talked about the green infrastructure becomes really important in placing it in places that provide multiple benefits. You're managing stormwater off the street. You're getting new street trees that create better placemaking and limit heat island effect. You're also creating better crossing situations and sort of safer pedestrian environments. So you're getting more multiple benefits out of your infrastructure. And ultimately, the people who live and work in those neighborhoods, they have to be engaged. They have to be part of this effort. And if you think about it, in my neighborhood in Portland, it's very easy for me to bike or walk to the store, to my kids' school, to work. But I get to choose. I could drive a car. I can do whatever I want. It's up to me. And ultimately, those who live in our neighborhoods, we all make the choices. So we have to actively be part of the process of making choices that improve our sustainability performance. So that's a little tour, a little history. A little visualization of what we have in mind when we put the eco districts process together. I want to just transition into the history of eco districts, in that it's in context. It's really important that we didn't start in Portland by talking about eco districts or green buildings. We have a longer history of growth management, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. But specifically in the last 3 years, this sort of notion of eco-districts or green neighborhoods has exploded. It reminds me of the early days of green building. I was around when there was 300 people at the green building conference, the second green building conference that now over 20,000 people go to. It was held at Shalishan in Oregon. We all introduced ourselves. It took a while, but we got around to the 300 people. And, you know, it was a small, crazy group of people. And, you know, look at how it's transformed, how smartly the green building industry sort of transformed themselves and become very much part of the mainstream building and development and design industries. Well, I think with eco-districts, it's a much more complicated proposition. It's not just about someone who owns an asset and the designer and engineer and a facilities manager. There's a broader group of stakeholders in which the community is a major part of that and the city as well. But I still see there's a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of new planning tools and new metrics being developed that are going to be really useful for this kind of neighborhood work. We launched our program in 2008. We launched a research program in 2008 to look at best practices globally and develop a framework for the city of Portland. We launched a pilot program in the city of Portland in early 2010. And we are underway on a three-year pilot program with five neighborhoods, about to launch two new neighborhoods in the suburbs. And we're gaining a lot of momentum and some exciting developments through that pilot process. We've also produced an eco-district summit that I encourage you to come to in the fall in Portland, where we invite really interesting projects from around the world to share their progress and their approaches to eco-district work. And we're just launching in 2 weeks our first Eco-Districts Institute, where we're bringing 10 cities from North America, including Guadalajara, Mexico, and University of British Columbia, Boston, Philly, Austin, San Francisco, Bellingham, other cities to Portland. They each have a neighborhood scale project. They're each they're bringing their senior management to Portland to sort of figure out what the roadmap for those projects are. So there's a lot of momentum, even in a down economy when large-scale development is really repressed. There's still a tremendous appetite to get in front of these projects before they take off. And in Shoreline, you have two light rail stations that are coming in the next 10 years. You're going to have the opportunity to really do something spectacular in Shoreline if you get your planning and your comp plan in place and you start thinking about the kind of investments you need to make in preparation for that. But this doesn't come without the kind of groundwork that needs to precede it, and I think the comp plan work that you're doing here is sort of just the important kind of framework that can make ecodistricts and contextualize ecodistricts in an important way. So it's not an outlier initiative; it's part of a broader smart growth and community planning process. These are some of the plan documents from Portland over the last 30 years, Climate Action Plan, Senate Bill 100 that led to our growth management in the state of Oregon, our green building policy from 2010. They all add up to a significant investment scheme around green development, but it does start at the land use, and this is just, I thought I'd just share with you for a few minutes some of the activities in the Portland region as it relates to contextualizing for ecodistricts. So this was the first urban growth boundary that was put in place in 1979 in Portland. What's interesting about the urban growth boundary, and then the colored sections on the sort of outline fringes are the expansions to the urban growth boundary since 1979. 89% of all new development since 1979 has happened within the existing urban growth boundary, even though it's grown over time. And this is it's a pretty obvious reason for that. That's because that's where the infrastructure tends to be. What we know is even though Metro is required to offer up a 20-year supply of land at any given time, it's very expensive to provision that land for infrastructure. And we've become, we're not as, our public agencies, our cities don't have the resources they once did. Our federal government isn't supporting the development of sprawl as robustly as we used to. The highway monies are not coming any faster than they used to. So all of that kind of sprawl development is slowed significantly. We'd like to think that the growth boundaries had a lot to do with smart growth in Portland, but the dirty secret is if you go around the suburbs of Portland, they look like every other suburb, and even though we've done a tremendous job of putting in light rail throughout the region, we don't have the transit-oriented development that we would like to see in many of those station areas. We've done a good job of planning, but as some leaders say, we've done a lousy job on implementation, with the exception of transportation. We've done with our transit, our light rail especially. But we did layer in, on top of the urban growth boundary, a regional growth strategy called 2040. This was adopted in 1994. And you can see here it's sort of provides a broad view of our overall regional strategy in which rail kind of dominates the where the centers and the town centers and the regional centers go, and it helps us concentrate our zoning. In essence, this is to help guide zoning and transportation infrastructure development. Again, many of these outline transit-oriented development nodes haven't developed as quickly as we would hope. But it does provide the framework, and because we're one of the few regional governments in the country, we actually have the teeth to require certain zoning requirements of the 25 communities that surround Portland. So we have a concerted central strategy, not without its hiccups, but it does provide the framework. We did something interesting last year. We created an urban-rural reserve strategy. Now, this was intended to be a 50-year strategy to just identify which rural areas are going to be preserved. So instead of every few years going out and provisioning for a few more acres or a few thousand acres for the urban growth boundary, we wanted to identify the most valuable forestry and ag lands and then try to protect those so that it was a way to kind of do an inside-out strategy with the urban growth boundary. At a much longer time frame. So they just finished that work last year. That provides, again, a sort of a different strategy that's analogous and consistent with the urban growth boundary, but provides more consistency outside the urban growth boundary about what properties are going to be protected in the long haul for the farmers and the foresters who own those lands. Created a bike master plan. We created a natural areas plan for the region, and we've set aside about 8,000 acres over the last 15 years, two bond measures. And all of that is added up to, you know, a pretty good, again, a framework for which eco-districts can sit in. But this is, you know, a typical edge condition at the edge. This is not, you know, the suburbs of Portland, again, have, you know, it's not sort of smart growth nirvana. It's a lot of, you know, cul-de-sac, large lot development. But it has been able to protect a lot of land in the making. You know, our vineyards represent about $4 billion worth of economic activity in the state of Oregon. Many of those are surrounded Portland. So we've done a good job of protecting ag lands over the last 35 years. As agriculture is the number one economic driver in Oregon, it's not a trivial pursuit. This is the major economic engine, or a major economic engine for the state. So why eco-districts? Many of these words up here, I think you would understand as sort of goals that cities or business communities would use when they're thinking about their own strategies. You probably use some of the same words in your comprehensive plan. More and more communities, over 1,000 in the U.S., have signed on to Kyoto and reducing greenhouse gas emission. They're not doing it just for sort of political purposes. They're doing it because it helps save communities money. Portland has reduced our greenhouse gas emissions by over 23% per capita since 1990, and that's at the same time our economy grew by 60%. So we're keeping more money locally flowing into the economy because of our greenhouse gas reduction strategies. No one talks about greenhouse gas reductions. They talk about livability. They talk about revitalizing neighborhoods and making the region ultimately more livable. But the greenhouse gas benefits accrue when you make those investments. Cities are looking for joint ventures. I mentioned earlier today to staff, our first eco-districts project that's going to be teed up is about a $7 million district energy scheme with our sports arena and the surrounding neighborhood. That's phase one. That's all funded through a private utility company. So the city doesn't have a dime in that deal. But it is a city-owned, one of the facilities is a city-owned facility. So instead of putting $6 million of new equipment in that building, they're going to save that $6 million to add to renovate the building in other ways. And they're going to pay for energy through a tariff to the utility services company. So that we've, in essence, created an opportunity through eco-districts to do joint ventures and to bring private capital into the end of the neighborhood. And there's a value proposition that we've had to carefully sort of knit together for eco-districts in our five pilot neighborhoods that speaks to each one of these constituency groups. You guys represent your community, neighbors and businesses, but the city, the utilities, and the development industry need to be behind this as well. And so the city's value proposition ranges from economic development to environmental performance. In this case, greenhouse gas emission reductions. Eco-districts helps the city get there. As it relates to utilities, being able to invest in utility investments that reduce overall costs is important. This is savings from our own stormwater and water utility by installing green infrastructure in lieu of pipes in a particular wet watershed that's currently under construction now. We're saving $63 million by doing green infrastructure versus a piped solution. This is going to translate into about 700 infiltration swales throughout a major part of southeast Portland. We are matching those investments with our bike master plan so that we are creating a green street strategy that's doing multiple benefits. It's creating traffic. It's helping on traffic calming. It's helping manage stormwater. It's first, you know, the most important thing it's doing. And then it's also becoming, they're becoming sort of important bike ways and sort of beautiful bike ways. So by carefully looking at infrastructure in a new way in which you're looking for multiple benefits, in this case, the city of Portland saving $63 million over what they would have to do otherwise. Eco-districts provides opportunity, again, for joint venture and for bringing businesses into project. So I'll use an example of one of our major catalyst projects at our university eco district, the Oregon Sustainability Center. It's envisioned to be a net zero energy building, a net zero carbon emissions, net energy, net zero energy, and net zero water use. It's a building that is highly advanced, but also quite simple. It's intended to be about 80% more efficient than a building built to the Oregon Code. And it provided us a vehicle to get into a partnership with Intel, with SolarWorld, and with Sanyo and GE, among others. We developed the spec for the building, and then we invited companies to participate as research partners. It's been a great project to date. There's about 40 faculty from the Oregon University system involved in the project. And it, again, as an eco-district project, it becomes a really important single building project that has multiple benefits to the community, to the neighborhood. It's going to be the sort of first investment in a smart grid strategy for Portland State. So by creating an eco-district's pilot program or an initiative here in Shoreline, you can start to not just do comprehensive planning and use it as a vehicle for comprehensive planning and real estate development or redevelopment. You can also link your economic development activities and be very explicit about inviting companies in, local or out of state or out of region companies, to participate to bring capital to the projects, which is always needed. And then there's tremendous savings that can accrue. And this is some research that was done by a Portland-based economist for the CEOs for Cities initiative out of Chicago. This was just what he called the green dividend from smart growth, the impacts of smart growth, and keeping dollars in the local economy. In Portland, we drive an average of 6 miles fewer a day than the national average in metropolitan regions. The average American who lives in a metropolitan region drives 22 miles a day, and in Portland, it's 16 miles a day. And that 6 mile differential adds up to 8 million fewer miles driven in Portland region in a given year. It adds up to 400,000 gallons of fuel saved per day, 1 million metric tons not emitted per year, and about $1.2 billion that stays in the local economy that's not going to outside oil and gas companies. So these are big dollars, and if you imagine our climate action plan that calls for us to reduce our total vehicle miles from 16 down to 7 by 2050, that's a huge increase. That's billions of dollars that would ultimately stay in the local economy because we're not driving as much and we're not using as much fuel. And in Oregon, unlike some states, there's no local economic activity related to oil production and refinement. We don't have any refineries. We don't obviously produce any oil. We don't have any natural gas. It's just in and out, and the only companies that that benefit are mostly gas stations and those who sort of truck and distribute oil and gas. So the ability to sort of link smart growth and sort of district scale sustainability to dollars and cents is always important. And the fact that Portland is $1 billion sort of richer, if you will, or thriftier than the average American city, that's significant. Those again are dollars that don't leave the economy, they don't leak out, and that's $1 billion that people have in their pockets to do other things with. So that's not insignificant at all. It's hugely important as we make the case for smart growth in eco-districts. Real quick, we did five pilots in the city of with the city of Portland. We presented to them a strategy. We worked with their planning department to identify neighborhoods. This is a heat map that the city did on the sort of most viable and sort of vibrant neighborhoods in Portland. Many of these in yellow are the most vibrant neighborhoods. These are mixed-use neighborhoods primarily. They have a school, they have shopping, they have childcare. It's the kind of neighborhoods where you can, at the very least, walk and get around very easily for a lot of your activities, and then you may drive or have to take transit to your job. In some cases, there's jobs nearby as well. The neighborhoods that are the poor performing neighborhoods are on the outer fringes of the city, is what you'd expect. These are primarily the neighborhoods that were unincorporated in Multnomah County. They didn't. Many of these neighborhoods still don't have sidewalks or even basic infrastructure, and they're really not friendly and places if you're trying to walk around and try to be able to walk or bike or get to groceries and other things close. There are a lot of strip malls. There's a lot of again, sort of sidewalkless and bad connections and sort of dangerous street crossings, and that's where a majority of our accidents between pedestrians and automobiles happen. So we were looking for neighborhoods, eco-district pilot projects that represented the sort of the swath of neighborhoods that kind of make up a typical city. So we've chosen two outer neighborhoods that are some of the poorest performing as it relates to transit use and greens, you know, green water management, and you know, have some of the worst sort of access to services and schools, etc. And we've chosen some very dense urban neighborhoods too. So we have three central city neighborhoods, and we have two outlying suburban neighborhoods. And what we were trying, why we did that was we wanted to determine what sustainability meant in those different neighborhood contexts. So what, in a low-density, low-income neighborhood, what would be the kind of projects that the neighborhood would want to see versus in the central city? And it's pretty interesting. It's not so inconsistent with, you know, the projects in the central city and the outlying neighborhoods being different. The first projects coming out of the gates in the in Lentz and Gateway eco-districts are low-income weatherization program and a green infrastructure strategy to link bike and stormwater management together. In the inner cities, we're primarily doing district energy and smart grid projects and bike sharing, a sort of a central downtown bike sharing scheme. So different sort of takes on the projects based on the needs and interests of the neighborhood. And this is one thing that's really important about the approach we've taken in Portland, is we've made it very much about community, a community-driven approach. So we are linking city investments with community needs and trying to layer in a new governance mechanism for these communities so that there is real leadership happening at the neighborhood level with money and resources to deploy on projects. We call these sustainability management associations, or as I like to say, it's sort of neighborhood 2.0. Instead of your neighborhood association getting together and griping about a particular issue, you know, focusing on a you know, something they don't want to see in their neighborhood, the neighborhood in contrast has real responsibilities about improving the sustainability performance in a neighborhood. An example of this is the Lloyd Eco District. 10 years ago, they had a real problem with single occupancy vehicle trips into the neighborhood. It's a primarily commercial neighborhood. And they were going to have to build expensive parking garages to support this increase in traffic. And they were at risk of being out of compliance with federal air regulations. And so they were required to do something about it. And they got after it with a transportation management strategy. And over 10 years, they've reduced transportation, single vehicle transportation into the neighborhood by 40%. So that's what we think, that's the sort of model for sustainability management associations that we're interested in. We want to see neighborhoods that have performance metrics and have the, you know, the capacity and the staff expertise to really manage their sustainability footprint. Another example, in one of our inner Portland neighborhoods, a young community organizer got a wild idea in his brain to do a cooperative purchasing strategy for solar. And so Tim O'Neill is his name, and he went around and organized his neighborhood, which was mostly single-family residence community, and said, if we could get 50 homeowners to start to purchase solar, I can go and negotiate a deal with a contractor, and we'll bundle the savings, and we'll bundle the incentives, and it'll be a good deal for us. His program outstripped our utility incentive programs by a factor of, you know, I think 6 or 7. He's been so successful organizing this is in inner southeast Portland. They had over 500 homeowners over a year install solar. The Energy Trust of Oregon, that's responsible for the whole state, didn't install that many throughout the state in 3 years. And now that model of community bulk purchasing has moved to every neighborhood in Portland, and it's moved to Eugene, and it's moved to Medford. In fact, I think it's moving nationally. It's just become this really interesting neighborhood-based approach to community marketing, community gathering around a particular issue, and finding economic ways to reduce the overall costs of the product that they were installing. And so that's what eco-districts, you're looking for those kind of innovations. It's not just the city installing new infrastructure or delivering a new program. It's also the community coming up with their own solutions in moving forward in a more robust and effective way. In each of our projects, we've had a scheme in which we're doing district-level organization, we're doing district assessment, project feasibility, and project development. So there's a method to our process that's consistent. It includes governance, as I just mentioned, and it includes using data and community asset mapping, asking the community what they want as part of that process. It's led to some really interesting opportunities in each of our districts. It's also part of a broader strategy. I mentioned economic development, for instance. So we've linked arms with our economic development agency and our university for linking research in each of our neighborhoods. So we have students and faculty doing a tremendous amount of work in each of our five pilots. The city's economic development agency has created an eco-districts strategy where they're trying to invite companies in to innovate, as I mentioned earlier, with the Oregon Sustainability Center. And we're developing training and curriculum development for our community members and for the development and the city agencies that are doing the work. And we've made all our resources free and available to anyone who's interested in them. We have a framework document that sort of lays out the whole program and the whole approach. We have a series of toolkits on financing, organization, policy support. Welcome, all of you to dive into those programs. I'm, of course, very interested. I'd love to see Shoreline take on eco-districts. Got the mayor here. So I would highly recommend that you think about taking a green neighborhood strategy and build it into your comp plan as you think about those key neighborhoods, those key interventions that could be really, wonderful spots for Shoreline as you grow. I guess with that, I'll shut up and offer up the floor if anyone wants to have a conversation and has questions or your own thoughts about activities here in Shoreline.
And since we are recording, we'll have people ask questions into the microphone, and then I'll give it back to Rob.
What have you found to be the most effective way to engage neighbors? Because my wife and I have tried to, get our immediate neighborhood together, over several years. And, part of it is the road doesn't, kind of encourage a lot of foot traffic and mingling and whatnot. But it seems like, people just, once they get home, they lock themselves in the house and, how do you pull them out of the house?
I could try to talk into this if that's helpful. I feel like Bob Barker in one of those game shows. that's probably the most difficult challenge that we've had. We three of our districts, the Central City districts, have very few constituents in them. So the Lloyd District, for example, has 10 major property owners. That's just because it's a home, it's a business district. And so that's a much easier conversation. In fact, they've been organized as a neighborhood through a business improvement district for quite some time. And then they have this additional transportation management association. So those neighborhoods have frankly been easier. The two outlying neighborhoods that are probably more analogous to the conditions here in Shoreline, we have deployed a very rigorous 2-year engagement process with some foundation support from the Bullitt Foundation to do community outreach, churches, farmers markets, local community development corporation meetings. We've really spent a lot of time trying to ask neighbors what they're interested in and what they want to get out of an eco district, what their priorities are. We have about a 20-person steering committee that was formed from that outreach effort in, and I'm using the Lentz neighborhood, or what we call the Foster Green neighborhood, as an example. The next bit of work that this group of 20 folks who represent major, some of them are just neighbors and citizens, others represent major institutions in that neighborhood. There's a hospital, there's a large community development corporation that provides affordable housing, there's an immigrant services organization, you know, there's a variety of organizations that service that neighborhood and are major sort of contributors to that neighborhood that sit on that steering committee. The next bit of work is to develop a governance model and a funding strategy for staffing that. So at the end of the day, I think eco-districts in this initiative, our pilot effort in Portland, would fail if you couldn't get to the point of having some professional staff who are in service to the neighborhood, who live and work in that neighborhood. The example of Tim O'Neill doing Solarize, he's a professionally paid community organizer in the neighborhood association, but he helped organize the neighborhood and the neighbors around a common project, which was installing solar. So, you know, I think it would be really tough lift for, you know, you to sort of take on such a strategy in organizing your neighbors. I mean, you would be, and you would want to see a lot of the neighbors sort of engage in that work, but ultimately, you need to have a steering committee that represents interest in the neighborhood, and you need to have a funding stream and a governance strategy that allows to receive money, whether it's through self-taxation or taking a small percentage of utility fees in the neighborhood to pay for the staff to do the kind of projects that you want to do. And that's, you know, that's been our experience with the Transportation Management Association in Portland. Again, you can't ask every one of those tenants and any one of those sort of commuters to sort of self-organize. You need a staff of three or four who are going to work day in, day out, helping them get out of their car, figuring out how to figure out a carpool or, you know, get on transit. So, we are banking our model on this notion of a sustainability management association, having professional staff that help drive it at the neighborhood level, and using kind of good old-fashioned community organizing to get that steering committee up and running.
Could you say some more about the size of that neighborhood that has like four staff, and a little bit more about the governance model and how that ties into city government?
Sure, great. That neighborhood is about 35 square blocks. It's about 60 square blocks of the Lloyd District in Portland. It includes the Rose Garden Arena, so where the Portland Trail Blazers play, our convention center, our major property owners, including Kaiser's Northwest headquarters, Pacific Power's headquarters, Bonneville Power's headquarters, a few hotels, a major mall. State has their state office building in that. So this district represents, again, about 10 major property owners, public and private. The Business Improvement District was formed using the same boundaries that we're using. They're doing, you know, like a typical business improvement district is using self-tax, you know, it's a self-assessment, and they do a variety of things from safety to clean and green to sort of marketing. That BID has got about 10 staff, which four are doing the transportation-related activities. They're able to pay for those transportation-related activities through taking a 50% of the parking, street parking revenue from meters and being able to use them locally. Typically, parking meter revenue in a community goes back to the general fund for general transportation projects. They were able to localize a portion of that for just neighborhood-based transportation. And that's one reason we're interested in doing that for energy, water, and waste. If you were able to localize some of those revenue streams that we all pay as taxpayers and utility, you know, we pay for our utility provision, and be able to keep some of those revenues in the community, then you could have professional staff who are trying to help you reduce your waste and energy, water use. So that's the snapshot of that neighborhood. The governance is through the Business Improvement District. That's how it got launched, and now they're launching this sort of a, you know, they're taking, they're riffing off transportation and creating a sustainability management association to do the work.
And the suburban city, like, what's the population of that?
That
kind
that,
of
the lens, yeah, the Foster Green, that's a much broader, that's a, that eco district is about 3,000 acres and represents about 7 neighborhood associations and about 23,000 people. It's highly, it's a huge district, and frankly, it's too big. I think it's one of our lessons is that you need to, we need to create smaller sort of nodal neighborhoods where you can do this work. And that probably will become a recommendation of the out of the pilot is that we will shrink that district down to be a couple key areas of the Foster Green area that they're looking at redevelopment for mixed use. Because in that neighborhood, what they're desperate for are, is services, you know, more shopping, local services, and better infrastructure to get around because they have such poor streets and sidewalks. So they're really looking at an overall green infrastructure strategy for the district, and then they're looking for nodal development and weatherization. Those are the three things that are rising to the top. But the governance in that district is going to be very, very difficult. I don't know if we'll get there, honestly, with a new organization that will have professional staff. We're working very hard to try to figure that out.
The question is, are you able to affect the municipal policy at the long term, in the long term context of planning, of expansion of transit to those underserved neighborhoods to cut down on the single occupant vehicles, do you feel that you have influence in affecting the long-term density planning for Portland, which would by itself do the same thing, also cut?
That's a great question. So Metro sets density requirements for the every regional city, including Portland. Portland has, you know, the most robust planning agency and sort of capacity of all the cities in the region, as you'd expect. The short answer is yes, we have, if you look at our policy toolkit, we've recommended a series of policies to support eco-district related activities. As it relates to transportation, and you know, it's a pretty easy equation that we don't have any secret sauce on, and that is you need more density to make, to make the economics work for transit agencies. There's only in TriMet's, you know, jurisdiction, which is the 25 jurisdictions plus a few other communities in Portland, I think only 30% or 40% of their service area is economical. In essence, they, you know, that's where the revenue is concentrated, and they subsidize the low density routes. And, you know, those low density routes are always at risk. There's certainly, you know, there's been a lot of cutbacks in the recession in many of those districts. So putting those neighborhoods and those districts more at risk. The simple answer, which is a simple answer, but it's a very difficult way to get there, is you got to have more density. And so part of the Foster Green eco district is about nodal development. We just installed a branch of light rail through that neighborhood, and so it's sort of, I think it's probably analogous to Shoreline coming up. I assume the light rail will come up 5. I'm not, or will, you know. And so it's likewise in Lentz, it came down 405 and lands in a couple, you know, difficult spots for multi-use neighborhood development. So it was not great transportation planning as it relates to sort of increasing density. So our challenge in Lentz is going to be building out these town centers that then sort of reinforce the need for transit. I mean, there is transit in these neighborhoods. They're just, it's lousy, you know, and it's actually not so much it's the problem which a lot of poor neighborhoods face, which is these people are not going downtown. They're going all over the place to get to jobs. And so, you know, even the most robust transportation system is going to be really difficult to meet their needs. So there's a lot of challenges, both sort of from sort of job placement to actually the provision of transit. But long story short, we are having an impact that we, part of the pilot program that we launched is with, it's with the city and it's with the Portland Development Commission. The Portland Development Commission is responsible for the urban renewal areas, in which each of these are in five urban renewal areas. And the city obviously sets policy around density. And because we were doing the work at the same time as the comprehensive plan, we've been able to influence how the comprehensive plan is thinking about density in these neighborhoods a little differently. So we are having the impact of using kind of a pilot approach to really, really force the city to think differently about sustainability being laid into what is traditionally just an upzoning, which is, comp plans tend to be mostly about zoning. So I feel like we are, playing a role in that. Transportation is a trickier one, though. I mean, it's just there's a lot more, as I mentioned, that impacts, the ability for people in that neighborhood to get around.
I really appreciate your presentation, just had it. It strikes me as listening to you, it's very customized and tailored to the individual situation and district. Are there any one-size-fits-all solutions that you've come up with? Things that you think are just kind of, I guess, no-brainers for almost everywhere, or are they all so customized?
We've taken an approach which is a framework approach in which the things that we care about that are sort of non-negotiable are governance, assessment, using a performance strategy and assessment method, and integrated projects. So we want to see projects that have multiple benefits. Those three things are sort of non-negotiable, but we recognize that every application is different. We chose not to go down the route of rating systems that have sort of, in essence, they already have prescriptive strategies because they already exist. We didn't want, that wasn't our intent. Our effort can coexist really nicely with a lead ND, which will tell you just how much, sort of service provision within a quarter block. And, there's a lot of really smart planning in lead ND or other green rating systems. We really were interested in cities creating sort of an overarching strategy and framework for doing these kind of developments in which there'd be a much more clear path of the city's role in that and provisioning infrastructure and its own programs, a clearer path for the community engaging in this effort around governance and leadership, and a clearer path for policymaking so that you can create a strategy in which the development industry knows what you're trying to get out of that neighborhood and what the incentives or the regulatory framework would be, and vice versa, the city would be very clear about the economic or the sort of livability attributes. So we're very much interested in a framework approach. So, there's certainly no-brainer strategies that seem to be popping. An energy, having a district-scale energy strategy is a no-brainer because there's huge incentives and appetite to do building weatherization and building retrofit at commercial and residential, and do provision of solar and other renewables. What isn't known is the cumulative impact if you were to create a smart integrated strategy, and if you were to start to look at 25% penetration in a neighborhood, 50, 75, what kind of carbon and energy overarching energy savings would you get? That's what we want to do so that you can contextualize the investments that you make and to start to sort of direct those investments in smarter ways.
I was curious if you could talk a little bit more about when you've had successes in getting beyond kind of the standard taxes and is in grants as the basic for funding, where you've actually got a value proposition, especially with large corporations, to say this makes sense for us to do this kind of investment.
Sure. So I think one of our early successes is with the Portland Trailblazers and developing a district energy platform that would serve their campus and then ultimately serve adjacent property owners. you know, in Portland, like Vancouver, when I was working on the Olympic Village, we weren't thinking at all about district energy. We, in fact, we knew we needed to do it in the Olympic Village, but we just simply wanted to let an RFP out to a private utility company and get the, you know, go build it. We don't understand it. We don't care. When we carefully did the pro forma, and we were guided very sagely by a consultant who I continue to work with up there, who basically, as he laid out the business case for district energy in the Olympic Village, we recognized the city was going to have a 7 to 9% return on investment. And the city got very interested in that revenue stream pretty quickly. In fact, they were thinking, boy, we could actually fund our sustainability initiatives with the revenue from this. And we can actually help control and guide some of the energy planning for the city that we've just let the utilities do all these years. And we recognize we have to play a more active role. So there's a very interesting role. And the city ultimately built the system, funded the system, and still manages the system with strike points to sell it to the private market at given times. So the same sort of thing is happening in Portland, where the city didn't know much about district energy. They actually had it in their climate action plan, but there wasn't much knowledge about how that would be deployed and how you would build a policy framework to encourage private investment or their own public co-investment. It started the very same way. We helped them issue an RFI for a private utility company to come in on the Rose Quarter deal. And we have that company, and they're going to make their first investment, as I said, of about $7 million. It's very much a dollars and cents conversation between the Trailblazers and the utility company. As we say with eco-districts, every project has a business case. Nothing will go forward without a business case. I mean, they will die. So, you know, that's one way to kind of calm the nerves of the business community as you launch something as radical as an eco-district strategy. Say, listen, we understand every project that gets ginned up and proposed has to have a very strong business case. Otherwise, we know it's not going to go anywhere. And in that case, the Blazers have become the major proponent for this system to all their neighbors. So, and because they actually have a marketing arm, because they're a professional sports franchise, they do it better than almost anyone could. So they, for instance, just launched, we were at the opening last week for the NBA Green Game, a new Eco Districts exhibit center in their concourse to tell the story of Eco Districts. And that was paid by the utility company that that is developing the system. The building owners are getting very interested in this. There's a new three-block mega development that's happening right up the street, 700 units of housing, about $750 million project. They are going to hook into the system because they are having business-to-business conversations with the Blazers and others about the value proposition. So that's just a small example of how you get out of sort of wacky planning and sort of, envisioning exercises into project development. And I think our mayor, who, you know, frankly went out on a limb with eco districts, and he sort of likes to go out on a limb, so it didn't bother him that much. But, you know, he recognizes it's all about project delivery. And he's also, like you are, Mr. Mayor, going through a comp plan exercise as well. So he's delivering the Portland plan, the first 20 comprehensive plan in 20 years, and he's delivering on some of these projects like Oregon Sustainability Center and the Eco District. So he recognizes the need for good planning, but he wants to use that plan to stimulate some interesting innovation in the community. And I think he sees Eco Districts as a natural fit for the comp plan, because the comp plan's all about, I think they call it healthy connected neighborhoods, is sort of the planning jargon that they're using. And eco districts becomes an implementation strategy to bring some investment. We will be highly at risk in the poorer neighborhoods if we don't deliver a project or two in the next year. I mean, we got two projects that we're thinking about for that neighborhood that in the immediate future. One is bike sharing, and there's a longer story around bike sharing. A lot of it has to do with bikes have become analogous with middle class hipsters in Portland, and for some reason there's a lot of middle class hipsters riding bikes. So. Some of the bike infrastructure being developed is going through some very traditional African American communities, and it's just become a flashpoint. It's not really about the bikes, it's about gentrification. And you know, larger issues that the neighborhood suffered through for many, many years. We want to use that as a lesson to go out and really understand the mobility needs of the Lentz Foster Green neighborhood and really ask the question, would you use a bike and how would you use a bike and what do you need to get on a bike and try to turn the conversation around, because obviously people need all kinds of means to get around, and if you can overcome some cultural issues and you can overcome some of the typical planning kind of investment city to community engagement issues, we think there's an ability to do a really interesting low-cost bike share pilot out there. That's one project, and the other is weatherization, and we're going to some local community foundations to build an energy strategy for these neighborhoods that would provide more money that traditionally is hard to come by to do assessment and to do community outreach and marketing. You know, most of the utility run programs, they just go for the lowest, you know, they're just looking for the easiest path to get a customer to sign on to weatherization. We really want to tackle a neighborhood-based marketing approach. And in that way, you're really talking to the neighborhoods about a program and an investment. You're not talking to them just about what do you want to be in 20 years as a neighborhood. So it's a really nice kind of bookend to the comp plan work that's been going out in that community to then quickly talk to them about an investment scheme to make their neighborhood a little better.
Okay, I've got a couple of questions, but they do sort of come together. So bearing in mind that Shoreline is not the size of Portland, there's a lot of talk about measurements and performance and business case. So one of the questions is, do any of the toolkits that you provide give insights for the type of data collection that needs to be done to build the kind of business case that needs to be built? And the other one is, property in Shoreline is very expensive. And so how do you make these changes without gentrifying a neighborhood and forcing people to leave or keeping people from moving in because they can't afford it?
You know, gentrification is a very tricky subject. Much of inner Portland is gentrified over the last 10 years and traditionally redlined and, you know, minority communities that were minority communities for many, many years. In fact, one of the Foster Green Lentz neighborhood is a landing spot for many of the African Americans that were in northeast Portland. They're moving out to outer Portland because of the issues you raise. I don't think I have an adequate answer for the gentrification question, other than we are looking for projects that have community benefits associated with it. So three of our performance areas attempt to address equity through reducing the burdens and and the impacts of the negative impacts, the unintended consequences of investment around gentrification, and trying to do that through projects that have multiple economic benefits. So weatherization as an example. We're looking at a weatherization program that has an agreement. We call it a high road agreement. It's an agreement around labor costs and provision of training local low-income folks to be able to participate as weatherization professionals. So that it's trying to develop programs, the initiatives in the neighborhood that have some threads that can sort of reach into the community and hopefully lift some people up through workforce development. And, you know, with weatherization, the sort of sad reality of weatherization is it doesn't do much to increase the value of your house. It's been a problem, frankly, is that, you know, you could put a marble countertop in your kitchen and, you know, blow weather is it, you know, blow insulation and do double pane windows, and you're going to get more value out of that, that granite top. I guess the good side of that is, you know, people who live in homes, low income people tend to live in leakier homes, homes that are less comfortable, and they spend a larger proportion of their income on energy costs or utility costs. So if we can really crack the nut on financing
and low-cost solutions, which is what we're sort of seeking in low-income, moderate-income neighborhoods around weatherization, we don't necessarily see that as a gentrification producer. You know, bigger issues are at play with gentrification when people see the opportunity to kind of reinvest in a neighborhood. The sad thing about Foster Green is that it's a neighborhood with such little adequate infrastructure that it's not going to be gentrified anytime soon. It's just think of the worst of the worst of lousy roads and sprawl and, you know, mini marts and, you know, strip clubs, and it's a tough neighborhood. So gentrification is really not on the table anytime soon. The first question around performance metrics, again, we've taken an approach in which we've got 8 performance metrics or performance areas, and they're intended to be tuned to the neighborhood. So if you had a smaller, say, transit-oriented site here in Shoreline that you wanted to do an eco district, you can tune those performance areas and sort of the data that you need to collect to that neighborhood. I mean, it's pretty simple stuff. It's like, what's the energy performance of the neighborhood? What's the carbon footprint, which is an equation based on your where you get your energy from? And what's your water usage in the neighborhood? And then you try to work towards very aggressive performance goals and then determine how you do that. Is it by, if it's an existing neighborhood, is it by retrofitting your faucets and your other sort of, you know, for water-saving features? Does it have to require rainwater harvesting for irrigation? You sort of go down the list of what your particular home or building would need based on an overarching set of goals. So it's intended to be, you know, sort of scale down to different, you know, size neighborhoods. We're more interested in the community kind of setting those goals. The goals are constant, but really determining how and when they get there. I don't know if that helps.
You mentioned partnerships, and you talked about the Trailblazers, and one of your slides had Intel, which are both based in the area. Shoreline doesn't have a lot of private business, and particularly a large private business. So do you have any recommendations about how you develop those relationships when they don't already have a physical presence here?
Yeah, we created a relationship with General Electric. actually went through the mayor's office. I think there's a lot of these sort of multinational, larger companies that have products to deploy or services like Cisco and IBM. They're seeking cities and communities that they can actually get their hooks into. And that's it's one reason why, you know, if you create an eco-district spec, in essence, you say, as an example, you want to do a smart grid demonstration in a neighborhood, and, you know, you're going to look at appliances. You're going to look at a meter strategy with your utility. You're going to look at, a community engagement effort. The community engagement effort may be led by a company, a nonprofit, or a community group. Your meter effort is going to be led by your utility, and then some sort of service provider that that provides for equipment and other sort of diagnostics may be out of community, but you've created the spec in essence of what you want to do, and then you sort of invite different sort of companies or partners to participate. You hope there's some local partnership, and then you may be seeking companies in region, you know, because, you know, Seattle's a large market shed, and bringing companies, Microsoft has done some really interesting stuff on home energy, for instance. You know, so you could create some partnerships that would be in region that could bring some economic benefit to Shoreline. There's a great demonstration, there's a smart grid demonstration that happened in the Olympic Peninsula with IBM and Bonneville Power, in which IBM was developing kind of a pricing scheme for conservation that tied into meter use and tied into kind of time of use energy performance. And, so they were working with the local utility. They worked with Bonneville Power for the region. And, of course, IBM's, you know, based in New York. So, but it provided a mechanism for very rural, you know, communities to participate in a really cutting edge program that saved homeowners a lot of money by sort of installing and testing smarter appliances and being very active with their management of energy tied to a pricing scheme that they save more money, you know, gave them incentives to save more money at different times of the day when energy was more expensive. So you would do washing, for instance, at night versus during the day because energy is is cheaper at night when you're more abundant hydro, those kind of practical solutions.
Other questions? Okay. We also have the opportunity to write down some notes here if you would like to record any thoughts that you have about how this should relate to our comprehensive plan, about policies that should be included. The back of the agenda on the table is also a comment form. Feel free to fill those out. Send them to me. So would you prefer to mingle and get out 10 minutes early, or does anybody have any things that they would like to record for the comprehensive plan?
Hi, I would like to ask that whatever changes are made to the comprehensive plan to support this area here, eco districts, and any other area as well, that they not be done at the expense of the property rights of the citizens of Shoreline.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you, Rob. Thanks, everyone else. We have one more series left in the speaker series. Date TBD. Check the website for shorelinewa.gov/2012update. You can see all the speaker series events that we've had so far. And thank you all. Have a good night.